Thank you, George, so much. And also, thank you, friends, for joining me this morning in Santa Fe, where we have a bluebird sky. And I think it's evening in Europe and other time zones are gathered here. I'm really honored to be here today and very grateful to have the beginning time, particularly a time when we can practice together. And I think that it's very important that we have this feeling of being collected at a time when there's so much uncertainty, so much disruption, so much chaos. So I'm going to ask us to begin by finding a physical position that really supports not only the body, but the quality of heart and mind we're endeavoring to nourish as we are together right now. And one of the most important qualities that we are touching into today is that of stability, equanimity, groundedness, holding all beings and things in equal regard. So for a moment, just allow your attention to move into the sensation of your feet on the floor or your sits bones on the cushion. And see if you can sense into this connection with the body and connection to this earth. It's not only the sensation of being deeply rooted, deeply grounded, but also being supported by the earth. So let the breath be in the body, in the belly. And feeling the strength and stability of the earth within our lived experience right now. And for a moment, shift your attention to your back. This is a metaphor that I often use for the experience of equanimity, that capacity to uphold ourselves in the midst of any conditions. The strong back, but not rigid, flexible, pliable. Conductive, strong back. And when the breath is deep in the body, it gives more volume in the torso, more flexibility to the spine. Strong back. That place of groundedness and balance that allows us to bear witness to the charnel grounds that many of us serve in, be it a hospital, a prison system, a classroom, and sometimes our family is the very charnel ground. strong back. Breath deep in the body. Allow yourself to physically experience the strength of the back. Even if you have back problems, it's okay. This is a kind of metaphor. But see if you can touch into that sensibility as a physical experience, as a somatic experience. Strong back. And shifting your attention gently to the front part of the body. This feeling of open heart, open lungs, belly open. Soft front, you know, this capacity that you have to expand your subjectivity, to include the world into your experience, not separating from. Strong back, soft front, equanimity, compassion. Again, breath deep in the body. Grounded, upright, open. I'm going to ask us to touch into our motivation. That is this a sense of really why we're practicing together. And in doing this, I invite you to bring some person or situation which is really fraught, bring it into your awareness. And see if you can, strong back, soft front, presence, this suffering. And also consider the absolute futility of self-centeredness. And how deeply nourishing it is to care for others. And as you consider this person or situation where suffering is really present, where you don't back away, but you bear witness to, there's the kind of resolve which rises up from your guts, from your heart, which says, I will do whatever I can to benefit this person or this situation. This is why I'm practicing. This is why I'm here right now. And letting now that sensibility move into the background of your awareness. For a few moments, let's simply be aware of the sensation of the in-breath and the exhale, while letting this vow to awaken in order to truly be of benefit to others, letting that perfume our practice. Grounded, strong back, soft front, I'm going to ask us now to bring to mind someone who has been truly kind to you. Could be a mentor, a parent, a sibling, a good friend, maybe your dog, who perceives you in a very unconditional way, I hope. And as you bring this person or being to mind, you can allow yourself to recall the experience of being seen, of being perceived. And the kindness and the love from this person infuses you. You can sense it now. And let this sensibility of loving kindness really marinate throughout your body, heart, and mind. The kindness that you have received from another. And maybe you never have received kindness. Well, I'm sorry. But imagine then receiving it. Just allow yourself to sense into what it can be like. Give yourself that on the next inhale and exhale. And now, if you will, bring to mind again that person who is struggling or that situation where struggle is present. And resting and transmitting this phrase internally. May the power of loving kindness sustain you. And may you be peaceful in the body, in this heart, and in this mind. Extending a kind of blessing. And I'm going to ask you to let go now of both the kind person and the person whom you brought to mind, who's struggling, and just come back to the breath in the body, letting your attention rest on the inhalation and on the exhale, really dropping into the body. I mean, part of this practice is developing this capacity to release or to let go, to not be sticky, but to be nimble and able to bring your attention to this or to that. So now the breath. I'm going to ask you now to bring to mind some person whom you feel is truly compassionate. Maybe you know this person. Maybe it was a doctor or a nurse who took care of you when you were ill. Or maybe a public figure who just manifests complete compassion and joy. And see if you will allow yourself to resonate with, to be in resonance with, connection with this very compassionate person. See if this person's flavor awakens that flavor also within you. Now I ask you to bring to mind someone who's really struggling and let yourself open to these phrases. May you be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. It's like sending wholehearted sensibility of great compassion and kindness. May you be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May you be open to receive love and compassion from others. May you be open to receive love and compassion from others. May you see your own limitations with compassion. May you see your own limitations, your own struggles with compassion. I'm going to invite us to presence internally. The difficulty, the struggle of this person we have brought to mind. And to imagine that in this presencing, this quality of presence allows us to bring that person's suffering into our experience as hot and heavy, dark smoke that touches this guarded heart, the strong front instead of the soft front, that melts that defensiveness from around the heart, and this heaviness disappears into the vastness of who you really are. And on the exhale, send a breath that is like cool and light, a kind of blessing. And allow yourself to work with this breath, not turning away from suffering, but being able to work with that suffering in a transformative way, a really courageous way. So bringing it in as hot, heavy, dark smoke. Touching this iciness, defendedness, the thoughts, the judgments, the guardedness around our heart, just melting that and opening to who we really are. And on the exhale, a cool and light healing breath. And notice if there's resistance, then you can breathe in that resistance. Just bring it in to your own subjectivity. And let it melt the defendedness, the fear sheath around the heart. And exhale, openness, the sense of safety. And now let go of the practice. Let go of the image of the person that you're practicing with. And just settle back into breath in the body. And whatever moment or moments of insight or well-being that you've experienced in this short time we've been together, dedicate it, give it away, offer it to another. And in my tradition, we say, may the merit of this practice nourish each thing in all realms and benefit all beings. So thank you very much. I kind of needed to do that for myself today too. You know, as George shared, my long background in Buddhism is in the Zen world. And in Zen practice, we actually don't do guided meditations. We do practices that, for example, enhance concentration. We also have a practice, Shikantaza, which is probably comparable to choiceless awareness. In our liturgy, we have content, you know, in our ceremonies that points to what's called bodhicitta, this deep motivation to awaken in order to be a benefit to others. But our practice is pretty plain rice. It's very direct. And as such, I wasn't introduced really to these guided practices until the early 70s, when I met Sharon Salzberg, whom I'm sure many of you know. And she asked me what my practice was, and I told her Shikantaza, or just sitting. And I asked her what her practice was. And she told me about the Brahmaviharas. And I was kind of fascinated. You know, I'm the kind of person who doesn't really like to be told what to do. So the idea of repeating phrases or hearing phrases didn't really align with my style. But Sharon, who's one of my closest friends, after all these decades of our friendship, but back then she said, do this, it will change your life. And I have to thank her for that. It has been a tremendously inspiring, what could I say, journey, working with practices from the various Buddhist traditions. So this morning we began with just getting grounded, also somatically oriented with this image of the strong back of equanimity and the soft front of compassion, and also of setting our intention, which is so important. This is not just a small self-improvement program that we're engaged in, but it really is something that has profound social and environmental consequences, that we develop the kind of strength of character that makes it possible for us to uphold ourselves in the midst of such complexity, such churn as we're experiencing now, and to bring our best forward. So I think that, we did a few then pieces of the Brahmaviharas, that is loving kindness meditation and compassion meditation. And then we moved briefly into the sending and receiving, or Tonglen, which I think is just one of the bravest practices I know. And I just want to thank the Tibetan teacher, Chagdu Tukul Rinpoche, who was my very close teacher for a number of years who shared this practice with me. You know, I think that most of you are aware that I've been working in the end-of-life care field for many, many decades. And I was so fortunate some years ago to be appointed as a distinguished visiting scholar at the Library of Congress. Why this was important for me at that time was that I was becoming increasingly aware in my work of training clinicians of what clinicians face every day, and how there was this deep increase of what we could call a deficit of compassion in medical care, and how this affected not only patients, but also clinicians themselves, and really whole systems. And so what I did at the library I was given this wonderful office and support staff. And I really wanted to understand something about the landscape of compassion. And the reason is that there are a number of wonderful compassion training programs, and including Buddhism is a big compassion training program. Oh, really powerful. But what I was seeing in terms of the training of clinicians, as well as teachers and people in human rights organizations, that compassion is actually not a feeling. And I know that's a radical perspective to hold, but I came to realize that compassion is an emergent process that awakens within the interaction of a number of non-compassion elements. And so when I was at the library, I developed this heuristic map of compassion because I realized that in order to train clinicians and others in compassion, I really had to know the geography of compassion. So I wanted to say that this time at the library has, you know, continued to influence me very, very deeply. And out of this, I also developed a tool called GRACE, which is a means for cultivating compassion while we're in an interaction with another. And I hope to touch into that at the end of this talk. And one of the things that was so clear to me in looking at this field of not only compassion, but why there was a deficit of compassion, you know, in the arena of medicine, where compassion is really essential, is that I recognized that there were challenges that clinicians, but also lawyers face, and teachers, and people in politics, and people in the environmental field, and in the humanitarian field, and even in business. There are challenges that are faced in terms of certain qualities that are considered to be essential for psychosocial well-being. But these qualities also have shadow sides. And I call these edge states. And in my book, Standing at the Edge, I identified five internal and interpersonal qualities that are essential for us, those of us who are in the service fields, that these qualities are healthily engaged, but they also have aspects or valences which are highly charged and challenged. And as I began to look more deeply at compassion and at the edge states, which I'll describe briefly before I get into more about compassion, but as I began to see that the way to transform these edge states from their toxic manifestation to the healthy side was really through compassion. As I said, compassion is not a feeling. It's an emergent process. And so I began to unpack altruism, essential quality. We wouldn't be alive save for the altruism of our parents. Looking at empathy, our capacity to be in resonance with another, somatically or emotionally or cognitively. Looking at issues related to integrity, what we mean by the term integrity and how we develop a moral character to meet a world which is so complicated and so compromised that many of us serve in. And also respect and how important it is that we engage respect. And then the last edge state that I explored in the book is that of engagement. The downside of engagement, which many of us know well, is burnout. So I realized that altruism can turn into pathological altruism. And that is, you know, selfless actions in service to others, whether it's our baby or our school children or our patient or our parent, it's essential for the well-being of society and the natural world. I mean, you could say that bodhisattvas are the ultimate altruists, but sometimes seemingly altruistic acts can harm us, can harm those whom we're endeavoring to serve, or even harm the institutions we serve in or the institutions that we're actually endeavoring to serve. So it's important that we understand both the high edge of altruism, but also when we go over the edge and down into what the social psychologist called pathological altruism. It's quite a term. And then I explored empathy. You know, empathy is that sense of expanding our subjectivity to include the experience of another. But when empathy is not naturally or intentionally regulated, then it can move into what is called empathic distress. And I often say a world without empathy is a world where we're dead to each other. But also empathic distress, that is over-identification with a suffering individual or a situation which is really fraught, or even, you know, watching the forest being destroyed by the corporate world. This sense of just like the feeling is it's our very body which is being harmed. But I also say a world without empathy is a world where we are dead to each other. And so having this capacity for empathy is really important. And yet we may carry too much of the load of suffering and end up falling into a pit of suffering ourselves. So empathy as an edge state. And then integrity. And this means that we have strong moral principles. But sometimes when we engage in or when we witness acts that violate our sense of integrity or the sense of beneficence, what the outcome is a kind of moral suffering. And this is the harm that we experience that arises within us in relation to actions that transgress our basic tenets of what it means to be a good human being. So moral distress is that pain or suffering, for example, when we see a way through, but we can't act on it. We're constrained by the institution, by individuals, or by our own constraints. And we can experience deep distress as a result of that. And moral injury, which we know from the military, but is more and more identified in the world of medicine, is this wound that results from witnessing or participating in a morally transgressive act. Moral injury. And so many clinicians have found themselves, you know, up against the wall in the course of this pandemic, feeling as if their vows to do no harm have in a way been broken by the institutions in which they're serving. Then another form of moral suffering is that of moral outrage. And this is this externalized expression of indignation toward others who've violated social norms. But you know, just as moral injury can be a wake-up call, a moral distress can be, so also can moral outrage. And maybe the most insidious is that of moral apathy. And that's when we're in a bubble and, or we don't care to know, or when we're in this kind of privilege, or when we're in denial about situations that cause harm. And this leads to fundamental moral disengagement. So I just want to mention the last two edge states. Again, the pivot is always compassion, and I'll share shortly how that works. Respect and disrespect, of course, is another edge state where there's horizontal hostility or vertical violence, where we disparage others and bully others. And of course, engagement can be an edge state where we actually experience futility, lack of efficacy, or we're in a poisonous workplace, or where we're overworking, and all this can lead to burnout. But even in their degraded forms, these edge states can really teach us and can strengthen us, just like the bone and muscle of our bodies strengthen in relation to the right kind of stress. So I wanted to talk now just a little bit about why compassion is the pivot. You know, as I said, compassion is actually composed of non-compassion elements. And what I have seen is that these non-compassion elements, and I entered into this kind of inquiry process, these non-compassion elements really came from a kind of thought experiment. So, for example, I asked myself, is compassion possible without having a quality of attention where there is high resolution, where there's a kind of brightness or clarity? And, of course, I think about what clinicians working in a hospital setting or teachers in, you know, in a school face with so many distractions where attention is colonized or fragmented so that the capacity to see things really clearly is compromised. So I concluded, no, compassion is not accessible where attentional balance is not present. So the cultivation of this deep groundedness, of being able to drop in and down, of having that quality of evenness of heart and mind, undefended, but with that strong back, with that strength. So we're able to perceive the truth of suffering clearly and also potentially the way through out of suffering. Then I ask myself, is compassion possible, for example, if one is not pro-social? So pro-social is a social psychology term, the opposite of which would be antisocial. So it's for individuals who are cruel, disparaging, angry, grasping, aggressive, and so forth. Compassion is fundamentally pro-social. It is about how we can benefit others. And compassion is not accessible unless it comes from a foundation of pro-sociality. of concern, of love, of kindness, of empathy, of gratefulness, of respect, and so forth. So the second piece is not just attentional balance, but there's this fundamental capacity of great kindness or positivity toward the world, even those whom have harmed others. And this really came into focus for me, working not so much in the end-of-life care field, but as a volunteer in the prison system at the Penitentiary of New Mexico, where I worked for 6 years on death row in maximum security with people who were in the correctional, so-called correctional institution for murder. And it was so powerful to come into a place where I could see the deeds of an individual clearly, not turning away from the truth of suffering, but also by the same token to see that even the act of murder, for those who are committing it, that is a form of suffering. And yes, accountability is essential, but it's to see things from a wider and deeper perspective. And I realized also that compassion involves this deep commitment to, at the level of vow, of living by vow, to dedicate one's life to be of benefit to others. And that through attentional balance, emotional balance, through a strong ethical and moral base, the capacity to look deeply, to not only attend to the experience of others and to feel concern for others, but to actually be able to discern or sense into what might serve others. What will really serve here? An appropriate response. And then finally, to act or to hope to act. So these are the four main qualities this compassion involves, this capacity to attend to the experience of others, to feel concern for others, to sense what might serve to benefit or transform the experience of suffering, and potentially to be able to act. Now, I want to just mention a few more things about compassion. I have a lot to say about it, but time is as it is. I was reading a beautiful book by Musso Soseki, who's a 14th century Zen teacher, called Dialogues in a Dream. And he articulated that compassion has three valences, but only one of those valences is true compassion. And the first valence is what is called common or referential compassion. And this is compassion that arises in relation to a so-called object of suffering. Usually, you know, someone or a situation, particularly a person that we're close to, someone in our in-group, a family member or co-combatant or someone on our team or so forth. Some situation where there's a context of familiarity. And, you know, most of us experience, not everybody, but experience some kind of compassion toward those whom we share close connections, whether it's our parents or our children, our spouse, our siblings, our pets, or maybe, you know, even our old tree in the yard. And we tend to feel more compassion for our colleagues and neighbors, or for someone who's suffered like we have. For example, you know, if like I lost my eyesight when I was a child, and so I feel completely resonant with people who can't see. And what is important about referential compassion is that there's a self and another. There's actually this kind of this referential compassion. It's dualistic. And then Musashneck, he talks about compassion that's insight-based and that's ethically and dharmically grounded. And he writes in a way very close to also what exists in Tibetan Buddhism, that compassion can have a more conceptual base. And what Soseki points to is he focuses on realizing the truth of impermanence, for example, or dependent co-arising. Or from my experience, from the point of view of an ethics of care, where the insight arises that this is the only thing that is right to do. And then the third form of compassion is non-referential or universal compassion. And this is, you know, according to Soseki and also to the Tibetan teachers, this is this universal compassion, which is where we are just soaked, if you will, in compassion. It's a kind of continuous unfolding responsive process in our lived experience, where we are embedded in a world. And I think this is what my old friend Francisco Varela was referencing when he said that compassion, which I say is not a feeling, it's a spontaneous, non-volitional response to suffering with no thought to self or other, or even to ethics. Tai puts it this way, it's the right hand taking care of the left. Or like in the beautiful Zen koan, it's just like adjusting your pillow at night. So no, I didn't say reverential. It's reverential. So it's that seamlessness of compassion. You know, it's Shantideva talks about it. He says, you know, you step on a thorn and your hand goes immediately to the foot to pull out your thorn. It is that sense, and I think Matthieu Ricard talks about this when he says, you know, you're at the ready with this response that is selfless fundamentally. So just to finish up this short summary on compassion, and I have so much I want to share, but we're coming into these final moments. You know, I developed this wonderful tool. I think it's a wonderful tool for clinicians, but then now it's been adopted in education settings, also in business settings, and used by humanitarian organizations. It's a very simple, very logical tool. And those of you who are long practitioners, you'll realize, wow, it makes total sense, but it's a lifetime. And you're right, a lifetime. But it's also now. And the tool is called GRACE. And it's a mnemonic. And it stands for this. And it's like in your back pocket. The G of GRACE is you're confronted with suffering. And the G of GRACE is gather your attention. You know, what is it to be grounded, to be really present right there in the midst? Strong back, soft front. The R of GRACE is recalling your intention, you know, your motivation, which has to do with this deep aspiration to not turn away from the truth of suffering, but to truly be a benefit to others. It's to understand how important it is that even though you might be flattened by the system that you've served in as a nurse or doctor, as a teacher, go back to why you entered into medicine, into nursing, into teaching. Remember what drew you. It was a calling. If if you go into the kind of work that many of us share in the prison, in the hospitals, in the classrooms, in politics. So recall your intention. Then the A of grace is first attune to your own subjectivity. See what your body is actually telling you right now. Just check in with the body. Your somatic experience is influencing how you see the world. What feelings are present as well? And also, what is your view? How are you seeing this? Your cognitive perspective. And this can happen in just, you know, a nano. But really understanding your own subjective experience, including the unconscious biases that become more conscious, if you give yourself that pause to check in first, attuning to yourself before expanding your subjectivity to attune to the other. So being in resonance in the second phase of attunement, in this empathic connection, somatically, emotionally, cognitively. How is your patient or your student perceiving this moment? And then the C of grace is consider what will really serve. What will really serve here? Grounded, vows engaged, tuned to your own experience, to the experience of the other, looking deeply from a place in a way of not knowing, but also not putting aside your expertise. Consider what will really serve here. And the E of grace is engaging, taking action if you can. And the second part of the E of grace is ending. How do you conclude the interaction? With appreciation, interpersonal, asking for forgiveness, whatever is needed to conclude intrapsychically or interpersonally. So that's grace, G-R-A-C-E, grace. So I wanted to just share that with you, that wonderful tool which we train people in. And there's a beautiful quote. You ask, what was the last one? It's engage and then end, the E of grace. So there's a wonderful quote attributed to the Buddha. I don't know. I've never found the source in the Pali Canon, but maybe you all know. But I, even if Buddha didn't say it, I agree with this quote. What is that one thing which when you possess, you have all other virtues? And then the response, it's compassion. It's compassion. What is that one thing which when you possess, you have all other virtues? It's compassion. And then the words of our good friend, His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. He says, compassion, it's not a luxury. It's literally a necessity. So just finishing up this talk, brief overview about compassion. It's to say that it is a necessity at this time. And I hope that we can realize it together and also for and with each other. So thank you so much. So C is consider what will serve. Okay, thank you all so much for listening. And George asked me at the end of my talk to remind you all about Donna. And I know from Upaya, we've done everything on a donation basis since the beginning of the pandemic. We thought we would be, you know, back to the regular world, so to speak, but hardly. And so these online opportunities that have been created by you know, your community, our community, and communities all around the world are so important at this time when many of us are in a strict lockdown. So I just encourage you to give generously to the wonderful Sangha Live program so it can exist and flourish. So wonderful. Now, that was a lot of content, not many stories. I would much prefer to tell you stories, but I wanted to give you some structure. I hope that's okay. And so I'm just looking. Commences virtual clapping. Okay. Yeah, Grace. Gather your attention. Recall your intention. Attune to yourself. Attune to other. Consider what will serve, engage, and end. It's a very efficient mnemonic, but I think those of us who've had years of practice know that it's a lifetime of work. So I'd love to take any questions that you have. I'm seeing thank yous, but... Oh, yeah, I agree, Janice. Great. Okay, any questions? Any thoughts? And I'd love it if somebody would come online. I feel like I'm talking to my mirror.
So, Roshi and Joan, sorry to interrupt, but if you click on the Ask a Question box, there are several questions written there.
Oh, wonderful. Okay.
Thank you.
So the first question, thank you so much, is, or the question, a dear friend is dying far away of pancreatic cancer. Is there anything I can do to help her over this distance? So Diane, thank you for that question. So I'm not a magical person. I'm very pragmatic, you know. My 80th year is coming on this year. And I tend to be very practical in a grandmotherly way as I age. So I just feel that the most loving and practical thing that you can do is, if appropriate, stay in touch with her. Touch in, not just like, how are you doing? But also nourish the seeds of life that are still very present in her experience. Beautiful poetry, music, good news, you know, and then to provide the kind of presence that might lead her to actually explore some of the existential issues in her life. You know, asking a question. What has been the most meaningful moment in your life? What relationships are important to you at this time in your life? You know, find a kind of heart of inquiry, so you're not just delivering the blessed goods, so to speak, but you're, if appropriate, in a relationship where there's mutuality, where you're learning through your questioning. I hope that's helpful a little bit, Diane. And then, Gustav, you've asked, how can we practice with the three tenets, not knowing, bear witness, compassionate action in the face of the climate crisis, to help bring about change within our local community? Gustav, you know, when Bernie first shared the three tenets with me, Bernie and Jishu, I was working in, you know, in the AIDS crisis and also in prison. And I have to just say, being able to sit with not knowing, not just ramping up around the catastrophe of someone who has a horrible illness, or someone, or a rainforest completely knocked out by cattle ranchers, but to see if I could drop down into kind of a beginner's mind. To look deeply and to ask, what will really serve here? and coming from not knowing. You know, Gustav, I mentioned moral outrage as one of the edge states. You know, it is important to hold people accountable, but it's also important to realize that the harm that they're creating is really suffering, originating within their own way of viewing the world. And so it's like, you know, I had a really hard time in the last administration in my country, but I kept saying to myself, the last person I would ever want to be is that person who was then president of our country. That is real suffering, that state of mind. Just like I learned from the men in maximum security. So it's being able to see things with what a kind of grandmother's heart, Robai Shin. It's this kind of mature view where accountability is part of the equation, but also being able to look deeply. So not knowing and bearing witness is not being a bystander, Gustav. It means actually it's samadhi. It is not separating from the truth of suffering or the truth of joy that's arising. And it's out of not knowing and bearing witness that compassionate action arises. So it's a lot can be said about this. I just thank you for your question. Really, the three tenets really changed my life. Thank you. So Mary Kay, can you speak to the suffering of young people, teens, 20s, who may be losing faith in what the future holds for them, given the climate emergency and threats to democracy? I see it sometimes manifesting in substance use and abuse, particularly among compassionate, empathetic young people who want to be of service to others. And Mary, I think you're so, I hear you. It's why here at UPAYA, we don't have teens here, but you know, we have young men and women who are part of our practice community who have faced and are facing a world that is pretty catastrophic if we, you know, project into the not too distant future. So, you know, can I speak to the suffering? Yes, it is. We have to understand how this is affecting the coming generations. And also, you know, I'm very political. Put pressure on the political bodies that be, that make decisions in relation to the corporate world, the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex that is really driving so much of the suffering in the world. And for young people, one of the things that we've learned, even though we've been in lockdown here at UPAYA, being able to cook for the unsheltered in our community has been a way that we can serve our community. It's finding a project or an endeavor at a scale that is not going to be crushing, but which mobilizes, you know, a sense of meaning and a sense of goodness, and not just having kids, you know, outside of that, but creating the means for compassion to be awakened. And what we know from the point of view of social psychology and neuroscience is that the experience of compassion benefits not only those whom are served, but also benefits those who are experiencing themselves. In other words, the one who is compassionate. And we see all kinds of interesting research about, for example, immune response and longevity and decrease in stress factors in relation to those who are compassionate. And I give examples in my book that I think are pretty cool, you know, pretty wonderful. So how can we in the older generation provide those opportunities for young people? I think that's really important. And the other thing is, it's like the triple win. Compassion benefits those who receive it, those who experience it, but also those who witness it. You know, it's morally uplifting. So I thank you so much for your question. I see somebody.
Christina wants to ask a question live.
Yeah. Okay. Hi, Christina.
Oh, hi. I mean, I wrote it in the little question box, so if anybody misses it, you can go back and look. I was just kind of curious because you talked about those, I think, the three valences of compassion. And the last one you described was universal compassion. And you also mentioned that it was, there's all that compassion is this spontaneous, like non-volitional response. It's this way we feel, like this immediate like response. And I was curious if you were referring to that kind of feeling arising in all of the tenets of compassion, because I was just curious if that was unique to universal compassion or if that was also something that you could see in referational compassion.
Referential.
So,
yeah. And somebody said reverential. I thought that was pretty good. Reverential, but it's referential. So the thing that Musso Soseki is articulating, I think, is really interesting, is that there's no self and other. In other words, you had this realization of not being separate from all beings and all things. So there's no self, there's no other, there's nobody doing something to benefit other. It's more this sensibility. And I, honestly, when I heard about this first in the Tibetan, the name of the book is called Dialogues in a Dream by Musso Soseki. So when I first heard about this, it was in the Tibetan context of non-referential compassion. I said, how can that be? And then I read Musso Soseki and I went, well, there he said it too. That actual compassion, there's no self, there's no other. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh says, the right hand takes care of the left. There's no priming of, you know, intention. It's just this spontaneous, non-volitional response. And I just want to read this beautiful quote from the neuroscientist Francisco Varela, who actually wrote this prior to the research that was done at the Keck Laboratory by Antoine Lutz and so on. Cisco wrote this. He said, it should not be surprising that one of the main characteristics of spontaneous compassion, which is not a characteristic of volitional action based on habitual patterns, is that it follows no rules. I mean, in other words, you can't really prescribe compassion per se. And that's why I say compassion is not a feeling. It is an emergent process that arises out of the experience of adaptivity, positive adaptivity, to the conditions of suffering in which we find ourselves or in which we are embedded. So that's pretty abstract, but I've written a whole paper on inactive compassion where I go into much detail, because compassion is often identified as an emotion, and I don't see it that way, not from the Buddhist perspective or not from the perspective of science. It's an emergent process that is completely context dependent, so it can't follow rules.
Thank you. I'll definitely read that paper. I'm just like, right. I knew this is my first time being here, so this is kind of exciting. I'm not sure. How do I like get off the video if I wanted to do that? Do I just like close it out? Is that how
Jorge? Jorge, I will. George can do that.
I will take you out. No problem.
Thank you.
So, Nick, this is a really important question you've asked. He says, part of my work is nursing end-of-life patients. I realize I'm very attached to achieving a good death for my patients. I find it very challenging on the rare occasions when, despite all the best efforts of our nurses, doctors, and hospice staff, we have a patient where we cannot keep pain or agitation under control. How can I work with that situation and support myself in it? Nick, this is actually a very important question. In a certain way, I feel that the end-of-life care field was done a disservice by the notion of a good death, both a disservice to the fact that death the dying process can often be incredibly undignified, can be very, very painful, and can seem, as a person who's dying, who might be super spiritual, like a kind of failure, a moral failure, that they haven't met the criteria of what a good death is. And it can also engage in coercive or manipulative behaviors on the part of staff with trying to, if you will, herd a dying person toward their notion or our notion of what a good death is. So, you know, my basic approach for decades, Nick, has been to do the best that I can to mitigate pain and suffering to whatever extent is possible, knowing that even the greatest medical expert in the world might not be able to be of much use. And I'm recalling the dying process of a remarkable woman who had vaginal cancer. And it went on for quite a while, and it was one of the most painful processes I've ever been witness to. And of course, as a woman, part of her caregiving team, it was particularly poignant for me, and also all of our caregivers were women. And this was in the early 90s. And finally, after 2 years really of agony, she's the right to die, of course, wasn't in our country then. And she asked to be given palliative sedation. And it was such a, you know, I had this kind of moment like, oh, is that okay? And then I remembered an interaction I had with the Dalai Lama, who, where I was in 1992 in Dharamsala and talking about this work in the end of life care field. And His Holiness, I asked, you know, about palliative sedation and also morphine use and, you know, mediating a person's experience in terms of consciousness and et cetera. And he said clearly, mercy. Do what is merciful. Do whatever you can to mitigate pain and suffering. And that really came home to me. So sometimes our notions of a good death might not, what could I say? Even our idea of what a good death is might not necessarily be a good death. Yeah, I hope that's a little helpful, Nick. We do the best we can, and then we just see. Knowing that any attachment to outcome will cause us suffering as well. So I'm going to take a breath. So, mudita karuna, well, that's very wonderful. You're asking about the experience of empathic distress. And I can really resonate with this. I can say in the story I just told about the woman with vaginal cancer, I experienced empathic distress as her caregiver. And I had to really get grounded and remember I was there to serve and regulate my experience of over-identification with her suffering. And you can be done in by empathic distress when there's such great identification with the pain or suffering that another is going through. So I encourage you to read my book. I'm not trying to sell my book, but it's pretty helpful around this particular issue. And the introduction to the chapter on empathy very specifically goes into how to work with empathic overwhelm, which includes going back to grounding, remembering really why you're here. So there we are, the first GR. And then attuning to yourself, getting grounded, and so on and so forth. Yeah. You asked the name of the book, and Helen, it's called Standing at the Edge. Standing at the Edge. Yeah, thank you. So Beverly is asking about listening, how to, and the great benefits of listening. Well, I've done a lot of talking. Usually I like to interact more directly with people, but in any case, I feel like listening arises really from an internal experience of quietness, of receptivity, and to allowing your opinions to stand to the side. And this comes back to the three tenets of how can you listen really in the spirit, both of not knowing and of bearing witness. Even if you think that what you're hearing is untrue or coming from a distorted view, still deep listening becomes a process that can make it possible for the person who's speaking to actually hear themselves. So you understand this is, it's like when you listen, it's like a transmissional process. You listen in a way that allows people or supports people to actually hear what they're saying. And that's moving your opinions out of the way and really coming from openness and not knowing. I hope that's a little helpful, Beverly. So probably the last question I can answer is, I said that compassion is actually not a feeling per se. It is an emergent process that involves attention. It involves intention. It involves our pro-social heart, that is a heart that really cares about and feels concern for the world. It involves our capacity to look deeply, to discern deeply, and to sense into what might be an appropriate response in terms of benefiting someone who's suffering. And these are a suite of qualities, some of which have emotional aspects, some of which are not emotional, like attention. But when they interact with each other, the emergent process is what we know as compassion, which is non-volitional, which is a spontaneous arising of, well, as Cisco said, it follows no rules, and that it's arising out of an emergent process that is coming from our lived experience and is completely unprescribed. So we have to understand that this non-referential compassion is spontaneous. It's unprescribed. It is contingent. It's emergent. It's unpredictable. And it's embedded in situatedness. In other words, it's completely context dependent. So my dear friends, we are at the conclusion. I'm so grateful to have had this time with you, and please keep safe and keep others safe. We're in a very time of incredible fragility on the one hand, and also possibility on the other. And we can do this. So thank you for your practice.